Mary Slessor, missionary to Nigeria. As part of our Great Commission course and putting feet to our faith, we want to look at one of the most extraordinary single woman missionaries to serve in the field. Mary Slessor was born the second of seven children into a poor and troubled home in Aberdeen, Scotland. Although her mother, also called Mary, was deeply religious, her father, Robert, was a violent drunkard with very erratic work habits, they put it. He was mostly out of work, wasted money on drink and gambling, brought the family to abject poverty, fear, and misery. There's many a time that Mary was even chased out of her home by her angry drunkard father and spent the night on the streets. Aberdeen, quite high up on the east coast, you can see Aberdeen and Dundee. They moved to Dundee later on. You can see the geographic difference between Aberdeen, where she spent her first 11 years of her life, and in Dundee, where she spent the next 16. Scotland, the Highlands. It's amazing how many missionaries have come out of the Scottish Highlands, like David Livingstone, just for example. But it was said by Charles Spurgeon that as the Queen recruited many of her best soldiers from the Highlands of Scotland, so the Lord recruited many of his best missionaries from the Highlands of Scotland too. And it was an extraordinary upbringing that Mary Slessor had. When you think of David Livingstone, it's hard to imagine someone who could have been more poverty-stricken than David Livingstone. And yet Mary Slessor was far more poverty-stricken and had a far more disadvantaged upbringing than even David Livingstone. Because David Livingstone at least had a father who loved him. Mary Slessor did not even have that. Brought up in poverty, first in Aberdeen, later moving to Dundee for hopefully better work prospects, getting the father away from his drinking pals. Their one-roomed home had no water, no lighting, no toilet, hardly any furniture, just about every stick of furniture had been pawned or sold to pay for his drinking habits. Mary slept on the floor. Mary's older brother died, leaving her as the oldest surviving child. Mary's father, Robert, both of her brothers, John and Robert, died of pneumonia, leaving behind only Mary, her mother and two sisters. When her father died, the burden of supporting her family fell upon her shoulders, and so at age 10, Mary began work as a half-timer, spending half her time at school and half her time at the mill. She is working as a half-timer 6 hours a day in the mill. At 14 years old, she began working full-time, a 58-hour week at the looms. For the next 13 years, she was the primary wage earner for the family, needing to sustain her mother, who was often sick, and her two sisters, who were often sick as well. Although Mary was small of stature, she was extraordinarily healthy and survived where many others who were bigger and stronger than her, died. Her mother ensured that Mary went to church every Sunday, and not just any church, it was the Vysart Memorial Church. Her mother was a devout Presbyterian who read every issue of the Missionary Record, a monthly magazine published by the United Presbyterian Church, later the United Free Church of Scotland, and she informed her members of her family of it. She had read the missionary newsletters to her children, and this inspired her oldest son and her second son to want to be missionaries to Calabar. And it was at that stage thought impossible for a young single girl to go into the mission field. But as you see, Mary later did. Mary was invited to a widow's home for tea and some cookies. And she went in, and this widow, as she is stoking the fire, she said, "Now, put your hands close to you. Can you feel how hot that is? Can you imagine an eternity in hell?" And she started to speak to the children there. All the other children fled, but Mary of her friends stayed and gave her life to the Lord. She is terrified into the kingdom of heaven from the dangers of hell. She could not sleep until she'd come to repentance and faith. Mary became a tireless Sunday school teacher. She gave herself completely to working in a mission to the slums around the church that she attended, Vysart Memorial Church. Here you can see a memorial there, how to the glory of God and the sacred memory of Mary Celeste of Calabar, who as a girl worshipped in this building, then Belmont United Presbyterian Church of Scotland, born Aberdeen, and died in Nigeria. Now, when a mission was instituted in the Quarry Penned, close by Vysart Church, Mary wanted to teach her. And they were very skeptical that this young little girl, this short little redhead, could possibly lead a Sunday school in this very wild, gangster-ridden, crime-ridden, violent quarry pen. So the Sunday school superintendent said, well, if you can gather a class, then you can teach it. So basically she had to go and recruit her own class. She went into the pen trying to do it, and then a gang of thugs threatened her, you know, called her Carrot Top, because she's so red-headed. Carrot Top, what are you doing here? And this one with a lead ball at the end of a string started swinging it viciously over his head, coming close and close to her. And Mary stood still. She looked him in the eye. She didn't flinch. Even when it grazed her forehead with blood spurting out, she stood firm, staring him in the eyes until he backed down, lowered the lead, and he said, she's game, boys. Come, let's go into a class. And they went in, and that one who had cut on the forehead with this lead weight swinging around, he was the first one to give his life to Christ. And that whole gang was converted, and Mary was established as a Sunday school teacher. She had brought her own Sunday school in. And that was so important, because having experienced this in Queen Street Mission, confronting these street gangs, because she could stand up to the street bullies, she could later stand up to the witch doctors, the warriors, and the chiefs out in the field. And her principle was, you never back down. You don't show fear. You stand firm for the Lord. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. She had street gangs trying to break up her open-air meetings. The neighborhoods were blighted. Dundee was a real mess. If you've read the Charles Dickens books and you understand something of Oliver Twist and that kind of industrialization, that was what it was like in Dundee as well at that time. Remember, she's raised in this time in the 1840s, 50s, 1860s, same time as Charles Dickens writing his novels, Oliver Twist and Bleak House and so on. So these neighborhoods were her training ground for her work in Africa, much like David Livingstone's training ground in Scotland. Her church was named after George Vysart, a very respected name in Scotland. In fact, George Vysart was protected by none other than John Knox. John Knox, the man carrying the double-edged sword there, he was the bodyguard of George Vysart, the great pioneer reformer in Scotland, who later was martyred for Christ. Now, her mother's interest in missions and her memory of her older brother, who had continually spoken about becoming a missionary to Calabar, and then the death of her younger brother who was going to take his place, who was also dedicated to being a missionary to Calabar, because Calabar seemed to be the most exotic, interesting, fascinating mission field in the Presbyterian missions news. And so Mary began to wonder, is it possible that she could take her brother's place? Although single women in missions were pretty unheard of at that time, but she was a trendsetter. You can see on this map, by the way, Calabar just right there, where the Gulf of Africa meets, there's Calabar. So it's southeastern Nigeria. What today's southeastern Nigeria, where the Ibu people in particular predominate. In 1876, Mary left home in Dundee for missionary training in Edinburgh. The United Presbyterian Church, after training her in this institution here, trained her as a missionary teacher. She is assigned to a mission station, Calabar, in present-day Nigeria. She was desperate to go to Calabar, but knew that she couldn't be demanding as to where to go. She kept that a secret, and she thought that if she's willing to go anywhere, she's more likely to be accepted. And they asked her at the interview, would you be willing to go to Calabar? And she just couldn't believe this is the dream of her heart. This is what she's been dreaming of for over 12 years. And that was the place they wanted to send her, because that was where they needed missionaries. In fact, the reason why they need missionaries there is so many of the ones who'd gone, they had already died of malaria. It was in 1874 that the news of the death of David Livingstone settled the matter for her. She determined, I must take my brother's place. I must go and fulfill the calling of David Livingstone, Scotland's greatest son. So Mary set sail on the SS Ethiopia on the 5th of August, 1876. arriving at a destination West Africa just a month later. This is the ship that she traveled on. And she was horrified to discover, as she arrived in Calabar, that not only were missionaries coming off the ship, but vast amounts of alcohol as well. And discovered that the traders were using alcohol, firearms, and a whole lot of other things, which weren't going to improve the life of the people. They were traveling on the same ship, and she was aghast over the fact that her country was contributing to the decline of this culture. The people were in a bad way anyway, and adding alcohol to it was no good. And this is what the people were trading for. This is what you would have seen. Old Calabar factories near Duketown. These are some of the factories and businesses set up by English traders in the area. And the missionaries were a little bit higher up the hill because they found being too close to water, too much malaria. So Mary Slessor, when she arrived in Africa, was 28 years old, red-haired, bright, blue-eyed. She was a sunburned case waiting for summer to happen, and yet she didn't seem to care about wearing hats that often. She is out there in the places where no one else would want to go. She was first assigned to the Calabar region in the land of the Ifik people. She must have had a gift of languages because she acquired each of the languages and could preach without a translator very quickly. The tribes among whom Mary was sent were animists who worshipped the sky, they worshipped the sun, they worshipped the rain, they worshipped the spirits of the rocks, the rivers, the trees, and enslaving people of other tribes was an accepted entrenched practice. Now, to give you an idea of what missionaries are facing in the 19th century, in China, the people are facing foot binding. You can see how it was considered beautiful for women to have tiny feet. And so they literally bound the feet from the earliest until, now on the right you see a normal feet, which is what they should look like, and on the left what they look like after being bound. It was like people walking on hooves like a horse. And this was considered beautiful, but can you imagine the pain, the agony, how uncomfortable it is, how completely unhealthy this was. And so foot binding was something that missionaries were challenging in India and China, and were fighting, particularly in China. You would have heard the testimonies of Gladys Aylward, for example, the little missionary who was rejected by the China Inland Mission as not being suitable. And so she managed to earn enough money as a parlor maid in England to buy a, she couldn't afford a boat ticket to China, so she got herself a train ticket, and it took her all the way across Russia during a time that Russia was at war with Japan, managed to get into China, and later she became such a successful missionary. And I met the head of China Inland Mission a while ago at a conference, and I said, so how does CIM feel about turning down Gladys Aylward? And you could just see he was sort of seething at the audacity of me to ask that question. But I've seen people putting their, if the Apostle Paul applied to a missions organization today, he'd probably have been turned down. And in fact, I saw one brilliant article where the 12 apostles applied for a mission agency and all 11 were turned down, and the only one that was accepted was Judas. And that often would seem so, because if we take man's standards, we often, I mean, who would have chosen fishermen like Peter or a zealot and so on? But Judas would have probably been accepted. Now, what Mary Slessor had to confront was not foot binding, but deforming of people, deforming of ears and lips and pottery type things put in to the lips, and head binding. This is quite common amongst many tribes. It was thought that it was more beautiful to have elongated heads, and so heads would be bound. And again, you know, if you know what it's like to have a headache or a migraine, how would you like having that all the time? And this was not unusual to see people doing head binding and all kinds of body piercing, all kinds of tattoos, and girls having their front teeth sawn out for beautification ceremonies by the witch doctor, of course, without painkillers. These were the kind of scenes that would have confronted Mary, and the people there were mostly naked, actually. Mary was enthusiastic. She was impatient. She found the progress of work at an established mission station far too slow. She ached for more demanding tasks and was reputed to have climbed every tree in the region. And when she's asked about that, she confirmed that's true. But frequent illnesses and attacks of fever, particularly malaria, almost took her life on a few occasions, but it didn't seem to diminish her zeal for winning souls for Christ. A number of missionaries she worked with died while she was there, and she was the smallest, the lightest skinned, the lightest head. She was the one most likely to die, you would have thought, and yet she survived. And she maintained a cheerful faith, and her heart was set on pioneer work in the interior, which was considered impossible by missionary rules at the time. This is a picture of the mission station where they were, and up on the hill, they called it Mission Hill. You can see some people have written over this card, sadly, but that's the only one in existence, giving an idea of what it was like at Old Town on the east bank of the Calabar River. The people were utterly degraded. Mary Slessor confronted widespread human sacrifice at the death of a village elder or chief. It was believed that if a chief died, his wives, his servants, his slaves, his retainers all needed to be killed to accompany him into the afterlife. At the death of one chief, 400 people had to be killed and buried, well, or burned with a chief in order to accompany him into the afterlife. This was considered normal. Amongst the many things which horrified Mary was the practice of killing twins. A woman who gave birth to twins was regarded with horror. She must have had relations with an evil spirit. And the belief was the father of one of these infants must be an evil spirit, but because they didn't know which one, they killed both. At least one of the children was believed to be a monster, so both twins were grabbed, seized, their backs were broken, and were crushed into a calabash pot or water pot, and they were taken out not by the doorway, but by a hole broken in the back wall, which was again built up. They were thrown to the bush where they left to be eaten by insects and wild beasts. Mary's fierce, red-headed passion raged against the massacre of these innocents, and she rescued hundreds of these abandoned babies. Mary Slessor lived in a missionary compound for 3 years. Let's see, Duketown, Old Town, where she started, and then she later moved up to Creektown and further up. Her first missionary activities was in Creektown, but she wanted to go up deep into Calabar. But she contracted malaria, and she was forced to return to Scotland to recover. So she left Calabar for Dundee in 1879. And when she's put on the ship, most people thought she won't even make it back to Scotland alive. Now, later on, in her second journey, she had a lot of opportunities to minister in Scotland and inspire people about the needs in the field, and recruited many more people. But she later adopted Janie. Now, this is one of a set of twins she rescued. There's a baby boy and a baby girl. One day when she is rushing around trying to help other people who are dying and she is tending to them, she came back to find that the baby boy that she had adopted had been taken and strangled to death and left dead on the path, obviously by the parents of the or from the tribal relatives. But they didn't get Janie. So she kept this baby girl, and when she was forced to go back on her second furlough because of sickness to Scotland, she took Janie with her. And that was quite a sensation. The people in Scotland had never seen a black girl before. And so she and Janie were such a sensation that the mission committee extended furlough. She was speaking at schools and churches all over Scotland and brought about a massive increase in support and of volunteers for the mission. She is also delayed returning back to Calabar because her mother and her sister were very sick and she was caring for them. But in 1885, after nearly 3 years in Scotland, she returned to Africa determined to penetrate further into the interior. She saved hundreds of twins from the bush where they'd been left to starve to death or be eaten by wild animals or ants. On one occasion, a woman was spread-eagled on the ground, nailed down by stakes to have boiling oil poured over her. She boldly intervened and physically prevented the witch doctor from harming his victim. And as he came swinging his spear at her, she stood firm like she had against that gangster in Dundee and made the witch doctor back down. And when he backed down and fled, everyone was astounded because her courage in confronting chiefs and witch doctors and the fact that she survived, they concluded must be the power of God which protected her. And so more and more the people turned to Mary Slessor, not just for medical help and for education, but to settle disputes even. This is roughly what it would look like in Dundee, returning to Scotland in the 1870s, and the kind of homes that people lived in. But don't think there's one family in a big house like that. Each family might just have a single room, as her family did. In the cities, it was very busy, overcrowded. And later on in her life, when she went back maybe in the 1890s, this is what she would have seen, typical street activity in Scotland. So quite a contrast. But after 16 months recuperating in Scotland, she was returned to Calabar, but not to the same compound. Her new assignment was 3 miles further into Calabar in Old Town. She supervised schools, dispensed medication, mediated disputes, and she mothered unwanted children. Soon she had a huge amount of unwanted children. And on Sunday she became a circuit preacher, trudging miles through the jungle from village to village, sharing the gospel with those who would listen. Now she is a Presbyterian. She didn't believe women should be preaching, but there was no one else to do it. And as soon as she could, she wanted to hand over to local elders. But the male missionaries sent to these areas she had gone to had died. And she was the only person around to do this. For practicality, she cut her hair short. She abandoned all Western comforts and Western food except for tea. She regarded one cup of tea a day as her only luxury. Don't know how many people regard tea as a luxury. She went about barefoot. And in fact, her feet were very badly cut up after a while. But it got hardened, I suppose, like Zulu tackies under the training of Shaka. And she was able, there were times that people were disturbed because her feet were bleeding, but she just persevered. Since Mary Slessor assigned a large portion of her support, she got about £60 a year in support. Now, £60 a year is like £5 a month. She sent most of that back home to care for her mother and two sisters who were so destitute. Imagine a missionary in such a destitute situation in Nigeria, thinking, but most of my support's more needed back home. And so she learned to just eat native food, live like the natives. And as I said, she went native. She was not needing the luxuries of the West. She said, I can do without butter and bread and all these luxuries of Western lifestyle. She moved to Creektown, where she began caring for many of the abandoned children. And she is constantly interrupted by people coming to her for help. The sick needed treatment, the hungry needed food, and those with disputes sought her counsel to bring about the resolution. So here's a picture of her with four of her first adopted children, of course, two sets of twins. You got Jean and Alice and Maggie and May. They took this picture in Scotland during her third time back visiting Scotland. Mary set up schools in Ekeng and Ifako, and soon churches were built alongside schoolhouses. And amidst rampant witchcraft and drunkenness and immorality, Mary undertook much of the manual work of constructing the school and church buildings itself, as well as daily tasks of education and evangelism. Just to give you a feel of the kind of person she was, at one point she was moving to another village and they were going there on a Saturday. And so the next day is going to be the Lord's Day. And so no work must be done. And they arrived so late at the shore on Saturday, it was dark, and they walked through the jungle, got to the hut, and everyone was drenched. It was pouring with rain. The children were drenched. Everything was drenched. The hut itself was pouring with rain. Inside was no good to be there. And she knew she needed good clothes and dry clothes for the children, and especially for Sunday the next day. And when the rest of the people coming behind her arrived, including one of the Scottish missionaries just helping her to get settled, hadn't brought the trunks and so on, no, we've left it to get it tomorrow. She got up and walked barefoot through the jungle 3 miles back to the, in the dark to find the trunks, got them brought through, before midnight because she didn't want anyone to work on the Lord's Day and didn't want her children going to sleep without dry clothes. And her feet were badly cut up as a result of walking just those 3 miles, two different directions in the dark that night. She served as a teacher, as a nurse, she dispensed medicines, and she conducted four services every Sunday walking many miles each day. And this is a note, a Scottish banknote that shows on the back Mary Slessor's ministry areas, working amongst the Ibeo, the Ikoi, and all of the different bases and towns where she set up schools, clinics, and churches. And this is what it looked like building one of their churches, and the different types of construction materials used, and the kind of work involved. Once, when she is instructed to heal a dying chief, Mary knew that if she failed, she would be blamed for his death. But nevertheless, she took the risk. First, she got rid of all the witchcraft charms and the sacrificed chickens. Then she prayed and gave the chief good medicine, and she nursed him back to health, praying fervently for a miracle. And when he was healed, his wives were particularly grateful, as they would have otherwise been killed and buried with the chief if he had died. So they were obviously keen to learn about the book, and they became some of her early converts. A report of Mary's pioneer exploits in the Missionary Herald prompted a young Scottish carpenter, Charles Ovens, to come out to Africa to help her with the carpentry. Now, he was just a carpenter. He never did any preaching. He wasn't comfortable with any public speaking, but he came all the way from Scotland to build her churches, windows, doors, other things needed. He's a carpenter. His arrival was a great encouragement and practical help, but he reported back that it was impossible to keep pace with Mary Slessor. In 1891, Mary was courted by missionary Charles Robert Morrison and became engaged. However, when Mary realized that she would have to abandon a mission to Calabar, and a marriage would mean settling down in Duketown, which is still in Calabar, it's still in the field, but it's just closer to the coast. And according to the mission board, she had to go where her husband was stationed, and her husband was stationed there, and so she'd have to abandon her pioneer work on the in the areas, the remote areas. She would not countenance marriage that would require her to give up the work that she's doing in this pioneer area, where no male missionary had survived, by the way. They'd all died who'd gone to the interior. And the mission board was adamant that Charles Morrison could not survive in the interior, where she was surviving, funnily enough. And on that base alone, although they had a lot in common, she broke off the engagement. Now, at this point, the British government recognized that Mary Slessor enjoyed unparalleled trust in local people, who called her Eko Kaporo Owa, or the mother of all the people. Her ease with the local languages, the trust the people had in her, they saw they're coming to her anyway to settle disputes, so they wanted to appoint her as a consular agent, and she initially refused. And then the British governor had to explain to her, if you don't take this position, we will send someone else out from Britain who doesn't know the people or love them like you do. Do you want the British consul in this area to be a missionary who knows and loves the people, or do you want some bureaucrat sent out from the British Isles who we have no choice? If we ask for someone to be sent out from Britain, we could get anything. And she took the job, realizing that the alternative was probably not going to be good for her people. So she accepted the role of being consular agent. Later, she was promoted to being vice president of the Ituu Native Court, and all the public affairs of the Okoyong were conducted through her. Now, bearing in mind how the local people in Nigeria looked down on women and didn't give them any position of any kind of authority, the fact that they turned to this missionary woman is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, this is a time where she couldn't have had this position back in Scotland. And here she was, not only being recognized by the British government, but even by the local chiefs as a person that they trusted to resolve disputes. When Mary was desperately ill in 1883, a sister died in Scotland, and she then received news of her mother's death, followed soon by the news of the death of her other sister. All of her family was now dead. Of her seven siblings, she is the only one alive, and she had lost both parents. These were dark and difficult days for Mary, because home no longer existed. She threw herself even more wholeheartedly into serving a new adopted family in Calabar. She was overcome with loneliness and battle depression, and she wrote, "There is no one to write to and tell my stories to." She also found a sense of independence, writing, "Heaven is now nearer to me than Britain." and no one will worry about me if I go up country. And up country to Mary Schlesinger meant among the Ekoyong, a remote area that had claimed the lives of other missionaries, those who dared to penetrate beyond its borders. Sending a single woman to that region was considered by many to be an exercise in insanity. And that's the words they used. But she was determined to go, and she would not be dissuaded. She helped heal the sick. She stopped the practice of determining guilt by making the suspects drink poison. They called it trial by poison. They got the poison berries together. The person had to drink this poison. And if they died, it showed they were guilty. And if they didn't die, then it showed they were innocent. Trial by poison. Can you believe it? For the next quarter of a century and more, Mary Schlesinger would continue to pioneer missions in areas which no white man had been able to survive. Her reputation as a peacemaker spread to outlying districts, and soon she was acting as judge for the whole region. By the way, you may wonder, did other missionaries come to work with her? Yes, some did. But they either died or they gave up and went back. Neither male nor female missionaries managed to survive where she was. In fact, they complained that she was not just eccentric, but she tolerated vast amounts of rats and rodents and cockroaches and ants in her home that no other missionary was willing to tolerate. And she didn't seem too bothered by these things. In August 1888, Mary Schlesinger traveled north to Ekoyong, an area where male missionaries had actually been murdered. And for 15 years, she lived among the Ekoyong and the Ifik people. She learned to speak the Ifik language, made personal friendships wherever she went. She became known for her pragmatism and her humor. That didn't come naturally and easily. There were battles. There were strong conflicts. Sometimes chiefs were determined to frustrate her goals. Sometimes the chief's wives were determined to break her. But in time, she won all her determined enemies to the Lord. Mary Schlesinger lived a simple life in a traditional house with the Ifiks, mud huts, thatched roofs, mud floors. Her insistence on lone stations often led into conflict with the authorities, and she gained a reputation for eccentricity. Mary Schlesinger sitting in the middle here, and you can see people around are dressed the way traditional Victorian missionaries were dressed, and they'd complain about the fact that she didn't adhere to correct Victorian dress standards. However, her exploits were heralded in Britain, and she became known as the White Queen of the Ekoyong. Schlesinger continued to focus on evangelism, settling disputes, encouraging trade, establishing social changes, introducing Christian education. Now, encouraging trade was really, really difficult. All the tribes had the practice that if somebody died, it was assumed that the neighboring tribe was to blame. And so they would go on a raiding party, they'd enslave and kill people of the neighboring tribe. And there was no trade with neighboring tribes. It was just raids, slave raids, killing, this sort of thing. And so when she started to persuade them to start to trade with neighboring tribes, she had to teach them how to trade, how to negotiate, how to barter, and had to often go and communicate between the tribes that she had first evangelized, so that these people were quite uncomfortable about the idea of, we're going to the neighbors to do what with them? We're not going to kill anyone. We're not going to bring back heads or slaves. What's the point? And so to convince the people of the need to trade, it was much harder than may seem to us. She is a consular agent of the crown. In 1892, she became the first vice consul to Ekoyong, a government position she held for many years. And she acted as judge and presided over court cases involving disputes over land, debts, family matters, and the like. And traditionally, they said she'd sit there cross-legged knitting through court cases. She'd listen to all the people, they'd give the different sides of the disputes, obviously like an indaba, everyone has a say. Then she'd put aside a knitting, stand up, and she'd deliver the judgment, which would often be against both sides. And she would hit people hard with what they were doing wrong. She was held in the highest respect by the local people, but the British government would not have approved if they'd known of the extent she went into court cases. She never let legal technicalities get in the way of fairness. One plaintiff, while having a suit upheld against another, was punished for not treating his mother properly, for failing to maintain adequate hygiene, and for neglecting his farm. In fact, she would do things like ordering somebody who had mistreated his mother to be beaten by other tribes members and things like this. If the British had known what was going on in the courts, they probably wouldn't have been that excited. But the people on the ground loved her. They believed she was a person of justice. Mary was seldom free from illness. And when the population moved, she moved with them. In 1903, she had the joy of seeing the first 7 young Christians baptized. And by the way, 5 of those were twins that she had rescued and raised. And the first communion service held. Mary Celeste was very isolated from outsiders during much of her missions career, but in 1893, she endured a visit from the famous Mary Kingsley, who's pictured here. Mary Kingsley was a British journalist who would later write Travels in West Africa. Of Mary Celeste, she wrote, "This very wonderful lady has been 18 years in Calabar, for the last 6 or 7 living entirely alone, as far as white folks go, in a clearing in a forest near one of the principal villages of the Ekoyong district, ruling as a veritable white chief over the entire district. Her great abilities, both physical and intellectual, have given her among the savage tribe a unique position and won her from black and white, you know, a profound esteem. Her knowledge of the native, his language, his ways of thought, his diseases, his difficulties, and all that says is extraordinary. And the amount of good she has done, no man can fully estimate. Ekoyong, when she went there alone, was given, as most of the surrounding districts still are, to killing at funerals, ordeal by poison, and perpetual internecine wars. Many of these evil customs she has stamped out. Mary Celeste stands alone." And she really does. It's absolutely extraordinary what she meant to achieve in the Victorian era in savage Nigeria. Shortly afterwards, she moved to the Etu, who were notorious as a marketplace for slavery and where cannibalism was still practiced. Soon she had gathered the congregation of 300 and established a school with 68 pupils. And it's at this time that she wrote the missionary newsletter back home saying, "Send Maxim machine guns," because they had slave traders to deal with. And I don't know how people would respond these days to a missionary newsletter asking people to send the equivalent of Maxim machine guns. So she's no pacifist. Despite illness and discouragement, Mary was tireless in her hard work and her pioneering of mission stations, schools, and churches. But fever and sickness constantly afflicted her until February 1915. At the age of 66, she went to be with the Lord. Now, the average white missionary in the 19th century was estimated to have a 2-year life expectancy when they landed in West Africa. 2 years. She survived way past what others would have thought possible. Her grave in Nigeria, which reads in loving memory of Mary Mitchell Slessor, born at Aberdeen, Scotland, 2nd of December, 1848, died at Uzi, Calabar, Nigeria, 13th of February, 1915. For 38 years, a heroic and devoted missionary, chiefly among the upriver tribes of the land. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that turn many to righteousness shall shine as the stars forever and ever. And you can see that bright metal marker has been weathered in the years. Because of her efforts, many schools and churches have been established, and the killing of twins ceased. Slave trading in Calabar was eradicated. Drunkenness, killing, witchcraft diminished. Most of the people of Calabar came to embrace the gospel of Christ. Do you know, the first time that a chief's son died, and they went on a raid and they brought back many of the neighboring tribes' people who they were going to kill at his funeral, and Mary went to extraordinary lengths to have constructed. She had the carpenter ovens there, a beautiful casket, and got beautiful clothes made, and had the corpse of this prince dressed in beautiful uniform and seated on a throne and with us there, and taught the people to sing songs and said, "I'm going to teach you a new way to honor the death of a prince of the village." And at the end, she said, "What he would want is that you'd show the magnanimity now of being Christians, of pardoning these people that you've brought here to execute and let them go back to their villages free." And men should talk the whole village into it when they were all geared up for, "Well, this is the way we've always done it." Very innovative, very strange ways of operating. Here you can see one of the memorials in Scotland to Mary Slessor. And in Scotland, there are many amazing stained glass windows of this red-headed young girl from Aberdeen, reading to and from work. Her audacity awed them. And teaching in the Sunday school. Then they've got down here, home sorrows. And first impressions of Africa over on this side. And it shows her ministering, the ships that she went out and so on. So this is erected by many Mary Slessor, Queen of Okoyong, admiring friends, Dundee factory girl, member of the congregation. Here's another one of the amazing windows that you can get in churches like Vysart Church, Presbyterian Church in Dundee. Here's some of the things that Mary Slessor wrote in her Bible in her own hand. God is never behind time. If you play with temptation, do not expect God to deliver you. A gracious woman has gracious friendships. No gift or genius or position can keep us safe or free from sin. We must see and know Christ before we can teach. Good is good, but it's not enough. It must be God. It may be a good idea, but is it a God idea? The secret of all failure is disobedience. Sin is loss. Loss for time, loss for eternity. The smallest things are as necessary, absolutely necessary, as the great things. An arm of flesh never brings power. Half the world's sorrow comes from the unwisdom of parents. Obedience brings health. Blessed the man and woman who's able to serve cheerfully in the second rank, a big test, being willing to be a good follower, servant. Slavery never pays. The slave is spoiled as a man and the master not less so. It were worthwhile to die if thereby a soul could be born again. Prayer is the greatest power God has put into our hands for service. Praying is harder than doing. At least I find it so. But the dynamic lies that way to advance the kingdom. We advance the kingdom in prayer. Daniel 12 verse 3 says, those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. For good reason, we have Mary Slessor on the cover of our Greatest Century of Missions book. She's one of the examples of excellence. This is one of the churches that she built in Nigeria, which still stands in Etu. Another one of the churches that she founded in Nigeria. And here's Mary Slessor's memorial cairn, where she died. This, at the top of this hill is where she died. It's not where she's buried. But here's a memorial that this marks the site of the house of Mary Slessor, the pioneer Scottish missionary who died here 13th of January 1915. In 1956, when Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain visited Nigeria, which then was part of the British Commonwealth, she had as one of her high priorities to visit the sites connected with Mary Slessor. And so Queen Elizabeth went and saw the house and the grave of Mary Slessor and where her mission stations were. This is one of the houses that Mary Slessor built, or should we say, Charles Ovens, who came from Scotland, the carpenter, built for her. Mary Slessor of Okoyong. And you can see the memorial there in 2015 for the 100th anniversary of the death of Mary Slessor. They had celebrations of her life. Mary Slessor Road, one of the churches in the area where she established the first church. This plaque commemorates Mary Slessor, born 1848, died 1915, mother of all the peoples, a missionary and magistrate who lived in the Cowgate and worked among the poor of Dundee from this building, the Vysart Church. In 1876, she joined the Christian mission in the Calabar region of southern Nigeria. She labored to spread her faith and to help others. Love suffereth long and is kind. The Scottish banks even produced a 10 pound note with Mary Slessor's picture on the one side and a map with sketches of where she worked in Nigeria. High praise. Many statues of Mary Slessor with her adopting of twins in Nigeria. In Calabar, you can even see at one major circle a statue of Mary Slessor with twins in her arms. 2015, they had the 100 years celebration of Mary Slessor, mother of twins, White King of Okayong, barefoot missionary. You see, there have been barefoot missionaries and centenary celebrations. She's one of the victorious Christians who changed the world and one of the heroes of the faith. Not just now books, here's some other books that are around in Mary Slessor. Mary Slessor of Calabar, pioneer missionary. Mary Slessor of Calabar. In fact, this one by W.P. Livingston, he is a missionary who visited her, saw her on the mission station in the 19th century, and later wrote a biography on her. These are just some of the many books written on her. The White Queen, God and One Redhead, The Missionary Heroine of Calabar, White Queen of the Cannibals, Servant to the Slave, Missionary Mother. Many titles. How many people have been inspired into missionary service as a result of this one life? She had a magic. The story of Mary Slessor, a Scottish missionary who went to the jungles of West Africa and became a legend that still lives today. The Barefoot Missionary. Servant to the Slave. Courage in Africa. White Queen. Christian Heroes Then and Now. Forward into Calabar. So these are just some of the books that are out there on Mary Slessor. She played a key role in the Christian history of Africa and has opened the way and made it possible for other single missionary women to go into the field, which was not considered possible before her time. So, any questions, any comments on Mary Slessor? Anything that I can explain more, because there are so many anecdotes on her life. Anything that maybe wasn't clear? Yes.
What will happen with Christianity in the areas where she can't?
Very strong. In fact, if you know the history of Nigeria, in 1967, the Biafrans seceded from Nigeria because they're strongly Christian and they had Muslim government. Muslim North was dominating and the Christian South, especially, well, the Yoruba were over in the southwest and the Igbo were in the southeast. Where she worked amongst the Igbo in the southeast, they were so strong, they managed to whip the Federals for several years, and only the assistance of China, Russia, Britain, America, and a whole lot of other countries, France and so on, helping the federal government enabled them to crush the Christian Igbos in the Nigerian Civil War of 1967 to 1970. South Africa was about the only country to give any aid to the Igbos. And Colonel Jan Breitenbach led a South African parachute company to Ibuland and was on the last plane out of Uli, which was the last airstrip left amongst these brave people, these Christians who were standing up to this wicked Muslim dictatorship. And it's a disgrace that Britain, France, America, Red China, Soviet Union all joined together in aiding the Muslims in crushing the Christian secession of Ibuland or Biafra. So it's to South Africa's credit that we at least try to help them. When I was at school, I remember the Biafrans being a byword for starvation. And the money at that stage was going to Biafrans starving there. And there was complete sanctions. You weren't allowed to send aid into Biafra. In fact, even a Canadian Red Cross plane was shot down by the federal forces trying to take in medical supplies into Biafra at the time. It was a vicious war. I've been there, and the people there are still super strong, dedicated Christians, very resistant to Islam, extremely strong in their faith. So there's no doubt that you can see from the celebrations, the commemorations, Mary Slessor is still seriously honored there. Islam doesn't have a chance in that area at all. People are really, really resistant to it. But it's a disgrace that they were not able to have their freedom, because why were Muslim houses dominating Christian Yoruba and Christian Igbos in the south. It made no sense. The British should have made at least three countries out of it. Nigeria's got 480 languages. It's actually 480 nations. It's not right to put so many tribes under Islamic domination. And so Nigeria's had six coup d'etats, lots of revolutions, lots of assassinations, and one seriously bad civil war. I mean, that was a civil war where millions died in the Biafran civil war. But in the early part of the war, the Igbos beat the federal government every time. And it was only foreign aid that enabled the federal government to crush the Christian secession of Biafra. Yeah, we've had some Nigerians here, and dealt with Nigeria and the Nigerian Civil War Reformation Society meetings before. The audios are available. And I asked the Nigerians who were in for the presentation, said, was this accurate? And they said, we didn't know there's anyone who understood what gone on. Yes, this is accurate. This is exactly what happened. So we've got these articles also on our website too about Nigeria's civil war and what went on. Absolutely staggering. Some very colorful characters there, including Colonel Breitmark, who was on the last DC-3 out of Uli as everything was blowing up around as the federal force were invading. And it was literally the South Africans were the last ones out. And that's still so secret. I don't know that any book's been written about the South African involvement in the Biafran Civil War. I haven't seen it recorded anywhere, but Colonel Breitmark was there. Learned it from him personally. Any other comments, questions?
I'd like to know how many languages she had to learn.
Oh, now that's a good question. She certainly mastered at least four that I can think off the top of my head, but I could be wrong. There could be more. At least four. So not bad for a factory girl from Dundee who is working full-time from age 14 and half-time from age 11. You know, just extraordinary. But again, it's when you think that David Livingstone, Mary Slessor came from such abject poverty and they could achieve as much as they did. David Livingstone becoming a consul under Queen Victoria and Mary Slessor as well. Extraordinary.
Yeah. One more question. So, with that many languages, how many Bibles were translated in those native languages?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure. She certainly did quite a lot of translations herself, but that's a good question. Other questions? This looked like an amazing amount of books. We've got a few different biographies of Mary Slessor here in our library, by the way. So I think she's one of the great examples to put before one. You think when people today, they talk about feminism. Well, you know, these are the real feminine heroes one should look up to. But these characters today in the name of liberating women, women's liberation has brought more oppression and less freedom, less respect, and more degradation to women. These are the people who should be lifted up as the heroines and the examples, not the characters they like. Margaret Sanger, she's no heroine. She just has pushed abortion. I mean, what's that achieved? And you can think of others that they're trying to promote these days too. Any other questions, comments?
I don't really understand how
indeed. She was obviously, first of all, because she's brought up in a very poverty-stricken environment in Scotland, she would have been exposed to just about every bug and every kind of, you know, like survival. But to think that every one of her siblings died of pneumonia and things like that, and she survived. So this is a case that somebody who was not brought up in a protected environment, so she's already pretty much immune to allergies and whatever else was out there by the time she got to the field. Maybe some of these other missionaries who went there came from very advantageous backgrounds and therefore they were more susceptible to the diseases. But it does seem amazing. How is it that male missionaries went there, they couldn't survive. And she survived. And of course, there's many a time, like after first 3 years in the field and she is forced to go back to Scotland, they did not think she had reached Scotland alive. So even then, she, but each sickness she survived must have made her stronger. I think it was some form of fever, yes. One of the many, many jungle fevers that would have been around, yes. Virus, tropical. Yes, probably, because they wouldn't have known. Interesting how somebody, one of the poorest subjects in Victorian England was a site of pilgrimage by Queen Elizabeth II. You know, Britain is very class conscious. And to think that the Queen of England visited to pay homage at the grave of one of Scotland's poorest of the poor. But it just shows that even in 19th century Victorian England, when class was everything, you could rise high, as David Livingstone and Henry Morton Stanley proved. I mean, Henry Morton Stanley was even more disadvantaged and poverty-stricken than even Mary Slessor. Henry Morton Stanley didn't even have a mother. I mean, mother abandoned him at birth. Father never made a stand. Nobody cared for him. He was an orphan from the youngest, thrown into abuse in these workhouses. And so you could say that Henry Morton Stanley was even more impoverished, and yet he was knighted by the Queen, Queen Victoria, raised to high level in Britain, a peer in Britain. And so even in the most class-conscious time of Britain, 19th century, you could still buy extraordinary ability rise above your circumstances. So that is interesting. But these are exceptional cases, very exceptional. But the thing is, people like David Livingstone and Mary Slessor inspired thousands, if not tens of thousands of others, to do things they'd never thought possible otherwise. That's why we need examples of excellence. And when you go into the school textbooks today, you can see they've got so many people who they've got textbooks in primary schools on Karl Marx, for goodness sakes. What they need is readers on people like this. So, any other comments, questions?
Yes. In those years, like you have just told us, that she was actually very lovely. How was the correspondence between her and her family?
Yes, there's some of the letters survive, and of course, in these different biographies, you get snippets. You could see a very independent-minded person, and of course, there were times that she was very caught up in this engagement and marriage ideas and so on, but her vision of the mission was just too high, and the thought of abandoning this field at this key time when she was seeing people from witchcraft being converted, and so she put her own personal happiness on the shelf for what she believed was more important and beneficial for the people in the field. She is a very duty-driven person, but I think, to be fair, that's Victorian England. Victorian England, duty came above everything else. Not everyone lived by that, but that was the standard. You're meant to put your duty first. David Livingstone did, and certainly Mary Slessor did. But to think the sense of duty to people who were not family, but they became her family. She adopted so many of the people in Nigeria that they call her even today the mother of all the people. You know, and you think that we've got such race-conscious communist propaganda nonsense out there, but you can't convince the people in Nigeria not to build her statues, monuments, have centenaries, commemorate, keep sacred the memory of the things she built and the place she was. So I think it's like when you go to Zambia, Zimbabwe, David Livingstone's the most respected name. You go to Nigeria, Mary Slessor is one of the most respected names, along with Bishop Samuel Ajayi Crowther.